The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So welcome. My name is Andrea, for those of you that I've not met before. And this evening, continuing the theme around the Eightfold Path that we'd been talking about for some weeks. And tonight the topic is, I'm hoping actually to get to both wise action and wise livelihood. But just a first a little overview around the Eightfold Path and what it is and what the context of it is. So the Buddha in his own path, his own journey, was asking the question, is it possible to be free from suffering? And that motivated his whole search to go out and leave home and study with some of the meditation teachers of his day. And he learned a lot of various meditation practices. And in one particular time, he was studying with some teachers who taught really deep concentration practices. And he found in that time that the concentration practice itself made him feel really good while he was concentrated. But then when he came out of that, he said to his teachers, that this just makes you feel really good while you're in it. You know, is this all that you teach, or is there something more that you know, or something more that you understand about alleviating suffering at a deeper level? Because when the Buddha came out, he looked around, and it's the same issues were still confronting him with respect to suffering. And his teacher said, "This is what I know." And so he struck out on his own to see, is it possible to find an answer to this question? Is it possible to be free from suffering? And in that exploration, he really found, I think, a definition of suffering, or a definition of what it's possible to be free from, that creates not changed conditions in the world, but changed conditions in the mind, changed conditions in terms of how we relate to what is happening in the world. And so this is the kind of dukkha that it is possible to be free from, the dukkha, the suffering that's connected with how we are in relationship to what's happening. And this is that we can be free from suffering in this way is really good news. Rather than thinking the only way towards happiness, and he said, this is a great happiness. This kind of freedom from suffering is a very great happiness. He pointed to it being beyond any other kind of happiness that he had previously experienced. And so not necessarily changing the conditions of the world, but changing the relationship in his mind to releasing the craving, releasing greed, aversion, and confusion around his relationship to experience, that this was a very deep kind of happiness. And that kind of happiness is possible, given that things around us are still kind of messy and crazy, this is really good news. And what I've seen, too, in my own experience of even tasting little flavors of that kind of freedom, that kind of letting go of greed, aversion, and delusion, is that it doesn't separate us from the world. In fact, quite the opposite. It really engages us in the world. It engages us in wanting to act in the world in a new way. Not in the same ways that we had been engaged, but out of compassion, out of generosity, out of care, out of love. So this freedom from reactivity doesn't create indifference, but really creates a heart that's very responsive to the world. And so in this this quest, or this curiosity around, is it possible to be free from suffering? The Buddha discovered in his own experience this great happiness, this freedom from suffering. And he also pointed out that it is possible not only for him, but for all of us to find our own way to that kind of freedom. And not through just learning about something, but through engaging in practices, engaging in a path of practice with tools that support us to understand the kind of suffering the Buddha was pointing to. This reactivity, the movement of greed, of aversion, of confusion in the mind in relationship to what's happening in the world. And so the Eightfold Path is this set of tools: wise view or wise understanding. And that wise understanding really is the understanding of what this suffering is that it's possible to be free from. Wise intention, the intention that arises from that understanding that encourages us or inclines us to act, to engage in this path of practice. And then the ethical component of the path, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, again, out of the intention to alleviate suffering in our own hearts. It's not just about us, we discover, that there's this interconnection or interrelationship between how we are in ourselves and how we are in the world. And so this aspect of the ethical component of the path, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, is really pointing to the relational component of our practice, how we are in relationship to each other. And in that curiosity or question of, is it possible to be free from suffering? The inspiration or the inclination, the intention is, if I want to be free from suffering, then it makes sense to engage in ways in the world that don't add suffering in relationship, that don't add suffering in our connection with other beings. And so this is this part of the Eightfold Path, this aspect of our relationship, our connection. We could think of it as wise relationship, this part of the path. And I love that the Buddha pointed to wise relationship and connection with our fellow human beings as being deeply embedded on this path of practice. It's not just about going and sitting in some cave somewhere and watching your breath. It really is an engaged practice, engaged with our fellow human beings. And then the last three aspects of the Eightfold Path are wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And this is an acknowledgement that to really understand and release the deeper currents of greed, aversion, and confusion in our minds, that we need to do some inner work as well. We need to explore deep inside of our minds, the conditioning, the habits, the patterns that tend to catch us, tend to keep us caught in this cycle of reactivity. That when we are experiencing greed, it tends to perpetuate greed. And if we're acting on greed, if we're acting out of aversion, it tends to perpetuate aversion, not only internally, but externally. That if we are responding in aversion and it's coming out of us, that tends to be met with aversion. And so in relationship, it's really helpful to explore and begin to release and let go of that, those reactivities in our own hearts and minds. And so in exploring this ethical component of the path, wise action and wise livelihood tonight. A couple weeks ago, I talked about wise speech. I want to just speak for a moment about ethics. In this Buddhist practice, ethics is not defined so much in terms of good or bad, right or wrong, which is often our usual way of thinking about morality and ethics, that it's about what's good and what's bad. But this approach to ethics is really practical in terms of what is it that leads to suffering? What is it that catches us in these habits of greed, aversion, and delusion? What is it, what actions, what happens in our minds and hearts that takes us towards suffering, and what takes us away from suffering? And so this is the ethical interest in the Buddhist path. What leads us away from this prison that we have ourselves caught in around this cycle of reactivity? And as we engage in acting out of greed, it tends to create more greed. We just kind of embed ourselves deeper and deeper in the cycle of greed, likewise with aversion and confusion. And so what is it that helps us move in another direction? So this is the ethical dimension of the Buddhist practice. What is it that takes us away from suffering? And the word for the set of actions and states of mind, it's used for both. The word that connects to actions and states of mind that helps move us away from suffering, in Pali the word is kusala. And that word literally, I checked this out today just to make sure this was correct. I verified that it, in some places where this word is used, it's used in terms of skill. So someone who might be a skillful potter, a kusala potter. So this is the, or a kusala archer, or somebody who has skill in an area. And so this is what is being pointed to again. It's like, what is skillful? What's helpful? Again, this is the term, or that the terms around morality are connected to this, not so much around good and bad and right and wrong. And so what is skillful? What helps us to move towards letting go of suffering? What helps us to move towards cultivating those qualities of heart and mind that support releasing suffering? And so, like with any skill, we can develop it. We can cultivate the skill that helps us to move towards freedom, towards happiness, this deeper kind of happiness, and away from suffering. Another piece that I stumbled on today as I was reviewing this topic, and I really liked this part actually. I found that there's this understanding or distinction about the Pali word is sila, that's usually translated as ethics or morality. There's an understanding that the sila of the Eightfold Path, the sila of wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, where wise speech is connected to refraining from false speech, refraining from harsh speech, refraining from divisive speech, refraining from speech that has no purpose. And then wise action, refraining from killing living beings, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from creating harm through sexuality. And then wise livelihood really essentially could be defined as that kind of livelihood that doesn't have us violating wise speech or wise action. So really kind of in that same terrain. So this kind of morality is understood to be what's called natural morality. It's in distinction. There's a separate word. The word in Pali is pakati sila. natural morality or genuine morality, as it's sometimes translated as. And then there's another kind of morality that's called Paññatti morality, that is conventional morality or conceptual morality or designated morality. And that morality refers to laws created by human beings, the monastic rules for the Buddha, aside from the basic morality laid out in the Eightfold Path here, all of those other rules that the monastics follow, those are what's called this Paññatti Sila, this designated or conceptual Sila. And I think this is an interesting designation, because that what this points to me is that the kind of sila, again, that's being pointed to here, the refraining from actions that create harm in the world, essentially, because sila is really about non-harming, the refraining from actions that create harm in the world is more of a reflection of what in our nature leads to happiness, a deep kind of happiness, and what keeps us caught in struggle and suffering. And so it's, again, this kind of sila that we're looking at in this part of the Eightfold Path is based in our nature. And to me, it's also important to recognize that, so certain laws, like, you know, not running red lights and, you know, a lot of the laws we have, aside from the laws we have about not killing people and not stealing things, you know, many of the laws that we have are conventions. And they're useful conventions. In fact, the word Paññatti includes the word for wisdom. You know, there's an understanding that there's some wisdom in there in terms of needing to come up with guidelines for how we live together. And yet, if we break one of those laws in terms of the onward leading of our path, the understanding is that it's not really connected to that part. It would have consequences in our everyday, in our cultural milieu, but not necessarily in our inner work. So the sila, the morality that we're really interested in, is this natural morality. What is it that takes us towards freedom? What is it that releases us from suffering? And the other piece I'll just point to in general about ethics is there's kind of the understanding of kind of the outer ethical guidelines, which is what this aspect of the Eightfold Path is. It's guidelines of action. The things I named earlier are guidelines actually for not acting. They are refraining from specific kinds of action. And so these guidelines around action are a reflection of this outer form of ethics. The purpose or the point is to cultivate what can be called virtue or an inner kind of ethics. And that virtue is expressed or is kind of expressed through these mind states, these skillful mind states, these kusala mind states of generosity and kindness and love and compassion and wisdom and those kinds of qualities of the heart and mind. And so there's these two sides of ethics. There's this outer action piece, and then the inner qualities, the inner qualities of heart and mind. There's a connection between these two. And in our practice, it's really important that we keep that connection in mind. Now, it's I think it's familiar to us that based on how we are inside, what our states of heart and mind are, you know, if we're feeling loving, we're going to act in a loving way. If we're feeling a sense of care and connection, we are going to act in ways that are responsive to that feeling. And so there's that direction of the connection between our inner life and our outer expression. How we are inside and outside connect in that way, that how we are inside does influence how we are externally. But through this, there's a quality in the mind, a kind of the intention of engagement. Through that quality, not only does how we are internally affect how we are externally, not only do our internal mind states and thoughts and beliefs affect our action, but also our actions, if we engage in these actions of refraining from harmful conduct, not just because we think we should do it, but with the intention to cultivate these inner qualities. So refraining from taking life with the intention, the connection to the intention to cultivate a heart of non-harming, a compassionate heart. Connecting to the intention to refraining from taking what's not given, cultivating the quality of contentment. Not just refraining from taking what's not given just because somebody told me I should, but looking, being curious, investigating, and kind of with the intention to cultivate that quality. These actions, through that quality of intention, have the power to influence our state of mind. I had this really clearly demonstrated to me at one point while I was exploring this first precept, exploration around refraining from killing living beings. I was exploring, I had a lot of ants in my kitchen at one point, and I was exploring not just, you know, either spraying them all with Raid or taking the sponge and wiping them down with soap. I was exploring, okay, how might I deal with this? And so, you know, I started with this kind of elaborate process, and they tended to be like all over my kitchen counter. And so I found out where they were coming in. They were coming in this little hole by the window, this little crack in the plaster by the window. And so I kind of began corralling them with soap because I noticed they wouldn't cross the soap line. They wouldn't go there. And so I corralled them with soap and then successively made it a smaller and smaller and smaller corral, kind of back to where the hole was. This took a really long time. I started getting kind of impatient with this. And at one point, to speed things up, you know, so this was, there was some impatience here. I acknowledge that there was some impatience here. But I would take a piece of paper and I would scoop up the ants on the counter and then shake them off next to their little hole, and then I could corral them a little more quickly. And then I did this for weeks. But at about the time I started using the paper, you know, at one point, while I was depositing some ants near the hole, I saw something that I had never seen an ant do before. One of the ants, you know how the ants, I had learned a lot about the ants. I saw, you know, how they like, you know, bumped up and like seemed to communicate when they like, you know, went past each other, and but this one ant I saw, right, it was just right at the edge of the hole. It was standing on its back two legs, like this. You know, imagine an ant standing on its back two legs, and it was like scanning, like this. I had never seen an ant do anything like this before. I didn't even know they could stand on their legs like that. But to me, this gesture, what this ant was doing, spoke of alarm. Now, I don't know what it was, but sure looked like an odd thing for an ant to do. And when I saw that, my heart broke into compassion for all of the ants. And so this practice of exploring, what does it mean to, how might we engage in non-killing? So that it created, essentially this created a connection between me, it created a relationship between me and these ants. And when I was open to that relationship, there was this possibility for compassion. And this is one of the understandings for each of these, for refraining from killing living beings, for refraining from taking what's not given, for refraining from creating harm with sexuality. Each of these is kind of paired with an inner virtue, an inner beautiful quality. And with refraining from killing living beings, it's paired with compassion. Refraining from taking what's not given is paired with contentment. Refraining from creating harm with sexuality is, I think it's paired with integrity in a way. And it's also said to be paired with fidelity. We'll get to some of that in a minute. And so this connection between our actions and our mind, it's not one directional. It's not just our mind that influences our actions. When we choose to engage in these kinds of actions, this can have a rebound effect on our mind. So I just want to go through these a little bit, each one. So one important piece around each of these, actually, so refraining from killing, refraining from taking life, an important piece around the way these aspects of the Eightfold Path are framed is that the taking of life, or the aspect that we are exploring, is refraining from the volition of killing expressed through body or speech. So this includes asking somebody else to kill something. But it's refraining from the intention to kill. Or I would say actually refraining from, well, it does say refraining from taking life out of that volition, out of that intention. That might seem like a kind of a funny thing to include, but it's really important for us to recognize that the intentionality piece is a part of the understanding around these guidelines around ethics. So imagine the difference, or just think about the difference in the mind. If you walk across the lawn and accidentally step on a spider, the spider dies. Versus, you see a spider on the wall and you pick up a shoe to kill it. So very different circumstances here. In the first case, you don't even know the spider is there. There's no intention to kill the spider. And so that is not understood as breaking that aspect of wise action. So it is around the intention. When we have an intention towards killing, that we need to really pay attention. an intention towards any of these. They're all of these are connected with the intention. So likewise with the refraining from taking what's not given. It's if you accidentally take something or take something that you don't know is not offered. Like for instance, when I first moved to California, there were flowers growing right along the edges of the streets. And I would go out walking and I would just like pick these flowers and just thinking they were, you know, kind of city property or something. And then I realized that people had these gardens right to the edge of the street. And it's like, oh, okay, that actually belongs to somebody. It's not offered. And so initially, I didn't know. And yet when I learned that, I stopped doing that. So again, it's there's the intention piece here that's important. And yet we do, I think, also need to take care when harm has happened. So, you know, that the case of walking across the lawn and killing the spider, if you are unintentionally doing that, you know, it's, if you happen to find out that there are a lot of creatures living in that part of the lawn, then it might be useful to, you know, to see, well, what might I be able to learn here? So, you know, so when harm is created, if we find out, like after the fact, without intending harm to be created, that harm has been created, it can be really useful to use that as an investigation. Is there something I should learn here? Is there something I didn't know or didn't understand? There's a story. It's quite a moving story. I've told it before, so some of you have heard this. About a young boy who grew up to be a great naturalist. His name is David Brower. And when he was young, about 11 years old, he had a collection of chrysalises, you know, the little caterpillars turned into these chrysalises to become butterflies. And he had a collection of these. And one day, he checked them out every day. And one day he saw one of the chrysalids cracking open, and he watched what happened. And he saw this butterfly beginning to emerge from the chrysalis, and he witnessed this what he saw was a great struggle, the pressing of the wings against the crack to open it, the distending of this abdomen, and this pumping kind of a fluid. To him it looked like this butterfly was suffering so much, but he watched the whole thing unfold. And the butterfly flew off. And then as the other chrysalids started to crack open, he wanted to spare those butterflies of the suffering. And so he cracked the chrysalids open a little bit so that they didn't have to struggle so much to get out. And what happened is that the butterflies walked around on the ground for a little while and died. Because they need that struggle in order to spread the fluid over their wings so that their wings can fly. And so he was kind of devastated by this. But again, so it wasn't his intention. His intention was good. And what he said is he learned a lifelong lesson there, that even things that we intend to do out of good, maybe the very opposite, you know, that they can create the opposite result. But in that case, he learned the lesson. What is it that I didn't understand? That suffering, that struggle was necessary. So to not like berate ourselves for that part, but when we see suffering is created from our actions, to not just say, oh, well, that's, you know, I didn't intend it, you know, learn from that. That's such an important part of our exploration around sila, when we see that harm has been created. I guess I'm kind of wandering around these. There are some gradations around these too, in terms of the kind of the understanding or the conventional teachings around each of these, that with, for instance, with the refraining from killing living beings, that there's an understanding that it's more ethically serious, or that there's greater ethical consequences, greater impact on the heart and mind to kill a human being than to kill an animal. And greater impact on the heart and mind to kill an animal than to kill an insect. So there's the kind of this understanding of these kind of gradations of different levels of how strongly or how much this affects us. And I think we, again, can look at this. We can see that, killing another human being will have a greater impact on our hearts and minds, a greater impact on our communities than killing insects. And yet, the understanding is that killing of any kind does have some kind of an effect on us. You know, it's not that. Sometimes people ask about, well, is killing ever justified? And there may be times when killing, even a human being, might be necessary to avoid more suffering. Like, killing Hitler, for instance, did that actually mean that far fewer people died following that? There's sometimes these kind of trade-offs, and so people sometimes say, well, how does the aspect of wise action of refraining from killing living beings relate to that situation? Doesn't that make it okay to have killed that being because it was in the greater good or whatever? And my understanding is that there are still consequences of that action. There are still, and yet there also may be the consequences of having saved other beings. So, it's the consequence. I mean, I can imagine, here's an example. In the Buddhist mythology, or in the stories, there's a story of a mass murderer at the time of the Buddha. His name was Angulimala, and he killed 999 people, it is said. And then he met the Buddha. And the Buddha was going to be his 1,000th victim, but the Buddha got through to him and basically said, you need to stop this. And somehow in that interchange, Angulimala kind of woke up and began following the Buddha's teachings. And it is said that he became fully awakened. And just imagining, being Angulimala, having killed 999 people, what it might be like to sit down and close your eyes and meditate. Just the consequences of that. The killing a living being, killing a human being, has that kind of consequence on our hearts and minds. We can block it out potentially. I can only imagine that that's what Angulimala was doing for the first 999 people that he killed. He was kind of putting up this delusional barrier. And then as we start to kind of look into our hearts and minds, we see what that means. We feel the suffering of the other being. And so there are consequences of that. There are consequences of that. And yet, the story of Angulimala is a story of redemption, because it is said that he became completely awakened. Complete freedom from suffering. So the even having killed 999 people, it is possible to transform the heart and mind. And so this is powerful. To me, this is a powerful story. That, you know, I think of myself every, you know, earlier in my practice, I really used this, you know, when I reflected on my life and thought about what I did these things, and it's like Angulimala woke up. Angulimala managed to free his heart after killing 999 people. I've not done anything near that bad. So yes, there's a lot to look at, a lot to, like, you know, let go of and understand and free the heart and mind from. And yet, so to me, this really points to the possibility of redemption, the possibility of freedom. So the only one I haven't really talked much about yet is this refraining from sexual misconduct. And this is, again, it's really about refraining from creating harm through our sexuality. All of these aspects of the sila part of the Eightfold Path are connected to non-harming. And so this is really what this part is about, not creating harm through our sexuality. The way this is described in the suttas is very culturally contextual. It's basically defining what is harmful sexuality of men, and it includes it's basically adultery, and including sexual relations with women who are not protected by or anyone who's protected. A woman who's protected. So, to me, these kinds of things point to this is a culturally conditioned or cultural, it's contextual to the culture what's appropriate here. So, while the non-harming through sexuality is more this natural kind of sila, the various specifics around it may be more in this kind of realm of panyati sila, the contextual or conceptual sila. So, for instance, the adultery in the Buddhist term was having sexual relations with somebody else's partner, but there was not anything about. It's like a man could have sexual relations with multiple women, and this was not considered adultery. So again, you know, contextual here. This is contextual. And so, you know, in our culture, we do have this kind of, in marriage often, this kind of commitment to monogamy, and yet there are different agreements that people make. And so again, I think we need to look at whether there's harm being created, and also whether any of the other precepts are violated. Are you taking something that's not offered? Are you engaging in lying or divisive speech or harsh speech in terms of this this interchange? I can imagine a situation of a couple that is completely open about having multiple partners, and that it is not a harmful situation. And yet, I think this is a really good time to look at, is it creating harm? You know, is it creating harm? Because it's so easy for it to slip for one person or another from being, oh, sure, this is okay, to suddenly it not being okay. So really, I think we, in many ways, with this particular precept, need to come back to looking at non-harming, and looking at the relationship and what the agreements are in a relationship. And then with livelihood, as I said earlier, the right livelihood is really about engaging in a living, a supporting of ourselves, our families, that does not force us to lie or kill or create harm through our speech or action. So that's probably the easiest way to think about wise livelihood. In the Buddha's time, there were some specific occupations that the Buddha said these are not wise livelihood, and these actually, in a way, these are not directly they're not directly violating wise action or wise speech, but they can head in this direction. And so the ones that the Buddha said should not happen, livelihoods that people should avoid, trading in weapons, trading in living beings, which includes prostitution and slavery, trading in meat, trading in intoxicants, and trading in poisons. So again, this is not necessarily directly creating harm, but it in effect, well, the trading in living beings seems harmful just in and of itself. But trading in intoxicants and trading in weapons, not necessarily inherently, and yet it creates the conditions potentially for others to kill or to harm others. So there's that piece of it too. And so looking at our livelihood, you know, where are we engaged? And I think there are some gray areas here. I mean, I don't know if the Buddha would say, you know, refrain from trading in computers, because computers are such a neutral thing, but they can be used for war, but they can be used for good things too. So, you know, this is a piece to look at. You know, if you are in some field or in some area where what you are doing is directly contributing to weapons or directly contributing to intoxicants, might be something to look at and reflect on. If you're forced in a particular kind of situation, or if your company is encouraging you to lie in terms of selling things, you know, you might want to see if there's another way to engage in that occupation, to explore this. So this is an area really where we need to investigate. We need to investigate. And I think all of these explorations around sila are an investigation for us. To me, they are kind of like a wake-up bell. If we find ourselves engaged in anything that has a flavor of creating harm in the world, to look at it, to reflect on what might I do differently? How can I engage differently? So I wanted to see if there's any comments or questions about anything that I've offered here. Yeah.
Hi. Hi. Nice to see you. that brings, I have so many questions, but I'm not going to talk about them all. Right now we're living in a time where there are individuals who many know they're not behaving correctly, but do it anyway because there's the greed and so many other things. But then there are those who think they are they're doing something correctly, like, you know, and are harming many people. And so the way I look at it is they have responsibility, complete responsibility for their actions, even if they don't intend to damage those particular ones. That's one thing. And then the other thing is, again,
But what I guess what I'd say there is that I feel that people, when they see harm is created through their actions, they have a responsibility to understand how that's happening.
Yes.
And that's what I was pointing to.
I got that from what you were saying. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay,
you know, that they're if somebody is not trying to understand that, they are embedding themselves in delusion, which is this, you know, this is the unskillful state of mind that is creating the repercussions of that.
Thank you. Great. I wanted to understand that clearly. I thought you'd say that. and then the other part is, it's so difficult to be in the world today without harming somebody, because at least, okay, I'm going to give a practical example. I have a thing, an app on my phone called Bicot. And you scan any product in the supermarket, in the drugstore, any of that. It's 99% have conflict. The computer, for example, you were talking about, the way they build the pieces in other countries, almost everything has either child labor or harms the environment. It's so disheartening, because you just don't know what to do sometimes, you know.
So again, you know, that I think you're right. It is so, like, widely, it's so hard to know, that we can really only do what we can do in terms of doing the research, in terms of what we purchase, and and exposing things when we hear about things. So yeah, we are way more interconnected globally than I think the Buddha ever had conceptualized. You know, that I think in the time of the Buddha, you could know, you know, like, you know, trading in living beings, or trading, you know, it's like, that's
very cut and dry.
Yeah. But here, that, you know, the way the iPhone is put together, maybe trading in living beings in some way, you know, and it's very hard to know that. So yeah, I think we do what we can, again, and to, I don't have a good answer really for that.
Except to do what
you're doing. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And well, at any rate, my problem is a lot of anger. I think I've talked to you about this before. Maybe we'll chat more.
Well, and the other thing to explore too, I think, is just general consumption, level of consumption. You know, that this, you know, taking what's not given. You know, for instance, we could expand that kind of injunction to not take what's not given, to being careful about our consumption.
That's what I do.
Yeah. So, you know, to what do we need, as opposed to what do we want? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we do look at the greed side of our minds, you know, to really come back to just what we need. If we all lived that way, there'd be a lot less problems in the world,
and there'd be a lot more help to folks who need it. Anyway, I don't want to keep going on because I can't.
And it's time to stop too. So thank you for those reflections that remind us all of the massive nature of this investigation. Thank you.